This episode is brought to you by Elo, the Creators Network. You can go to Elo.co or download Elo's iOS app in the App Store to explore, discover, and share your work on Elo's ad-free network. And with Elo's new Buy button, you can link a post directly to a product in your shop, empowering you to support yourself through your work and ideas. Elo, empowering creators around the world. As well as MailChimp, the easiest way to send email newsletters, connect with your audience, and grow your creative business. This is the Great Discontent Podcast. This conversation was recorded in front of a live audience at the Wythe Hotel in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, as part of TGD Live, a monthly interview event series. Your lovely and well-dressed host for the night was Tina Essmaker. Enjoy the show.
It's so good to be here for our 12th and final show of 2016. When we did the second show, I was like, oh, we have to do 10 more of these. Like, once a month is a lot more than I realized when we said we'd do it, but it's been amazing, and it's actually gone by really fast, and we're having a lot of fun doing it. So thank you for coming out tonight. If this is your first time here and you don't know what TGD is, The Great Discontent, it is a print and online magazine, and you can go to thegreatdiscontent.com and read over 200 interviews with some really cool people, artists, makers, and risk takers. You can also listen to past shows that we've taped on our podcast. You can search for us in iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and listen to those. So without further ado, I'm going to get started and introduce our first guest. Our first guest is a product designer and writer based in Brooklyn, New York. She specializes in using cultural studies and design anthropology to craft enjoyable product experiences. She's also the co-founder of Good for POC and the Guide to Allyship, two resources aimed at helping marginalized communities. When she's not designing, you can find her doing yoga, serving her community, or watching Korean dramas, or, as I learned before the show, also doing karaoke. Please welcome Amélie Lamont. So karaoke has actually been a theme in our shows, and it has come up before. So I want to ask, before I get to the serious questions, what would be your go-to karaoke song?
My go-to karaoke song would be Prepared from The Lion King. Yeah, that's...
That is so good.
When I do it, I actually act it all out, and I walk around the room because I, like, deep down in my soul, I feel like I'm Scar, so I just have to... Yeah.
That's incredible. Yeah. Okay, we're going to do karaoke Christmas.
We're going to do it now?
No, not now. We have to do a show tonight, so maybe later.
Okay.
All right. So I'm so excited to have you here, and I want to start at the beginning of your story. Yes. I know that you were born and raised in New York, and you are first-generation Jamaican-American. Mm-hmm. So tell me about what it was like growing up in New York, and also what forms of creativity you were most drawn to as a child.
Yeah. So what it was like growing up in New York... It was interesting. First generation Jamaican American. I was surrounded by a lot of Jamaicans, and Jamaicans are really interesting. They're kind of—I don't think a lot of Americans know the stereotypes about Jamaicans, but the stereotypes. One of my friends is in the audience. She's Jamaican, so she knows what I'm about to say. But they're very strict, and they're kind of crazy. So my mother, she would tend to have like 7 to 8 jobs at a time, and I would like go with her on those different jobs. And then I still remember like one time I came home from school and I got a B+, and she was like, "A what is?" And I was like, "It's a B+." And she goes, "Why not E?" And I was like, "Because I didn't get 100. And she goes, "Mm-mm. Take it back to the school and make them give you an ear." And I was like, "I don't think that's how it works." And I actually got in trouble for not getting an A. So the education part of it was like super strict, because from her perspective, she's like, "I did not come all the way to America for you to get B pluses, only A's, straight 100. So.
And were you drawn to creativity as a child? Like what forms of creativity were you into?
Yeah. So I did a lot of drawing as a child. I made comic books. And I was a huge nerd. Well, I'm still a nerd. I loved anime and manga. I also really loved the Powerpuff Girls. So I would make my entire, I'd cover my wall with just comics that I drew of the Powerpuff Girls. I don't know why, but I would spend entire days just doing that, or creating my own characters, writing my own stories, and then drawing out the characters.
And so when it came, time for you to go to college, mm-hmm. I know you are a writer as well, and you've shared some of your personal story on your blog. And so when I was doing research for the show, I thought it was interesting. You wrote about the pressure you felt to major in a more practical field. And I want to read something that you wrote on your blog. You said, "Fearful and thinking I was doing the right thing, I ended up going to school for business and engineering. A year later, I made the tough decision to leave. I was at the top of my class, but I was so miserable. I felt like a failure and a disappointment. But I knew that the only way I could be happy was through embracing my creativity." So I'd like to know, what helped you make that decision to leave college and pursue design at that point?
Definitely not my mom. When I told my mother, so I told you that she was very strict. So even just telling her that I wanted to leave to go to design school, it was a really tough conversation, because again, being a Jamaican immigrant, in her mind, she didn't come to America to have me grow up to be a starving artist. She felt that me being a creative, I would end up poor, I wouldn't be making any money, and I get it from her perspective. She just wants me to have a successful life, to live a better life than she had. But for me, the biggest support that I had was my friends, or were my friends. A lot of my friends were also creatives. And when I was in college, even though I was in engineering, I would see them doing all these projects, like typography projects, photography projects. And I was like, I want to do that too. So I would go to the art store, I'd pick up art supplies, I'd be like, kerning, how do I, sure, yes, this book tells me what kerning is, yeah, I'm a designer. And then I was like, you know what, I'm going to actually go to school for this. And that was kind of when I finally found the courage, because I realized how much I enjoyed being a creative and a designer.
Was your mom okay with it? No, okay. Is that for another night? It's hard. It's hard. I do agree. Our parents have so many dreams for us, and sometimes they're our dreams too, and sometimes they're not. And it's hard to feel like you're disappointing someone who just wants so much for you, right?
Yeah.
So I want to talk about this. Once you're out of school, there you have to build a foundation, and this is another thing that you've written about before, talking about how, if you are willing to build a foundation, you believe that you truly can do what you love and what you enjoy, even though we feel pressure to have traditional careers, whatever that means, to be successful. How do you build that foundation, or how did you build that foundation for your career?
So for me, a lot of that foundation building happened actually before I went off to college. So even though my track was to go into business and engineering, on the side in high school, I actually did drama club and art club and marching band and choir. And a lot of those clubs knew that I could build websites, that I could design, that I could draw. So I built sets for the drama club. I would draw yearbook covers, like all kinds of crazy things. And having that connection outside of what people expected me to do in terms of a major in college was really helpful, because then I could build my portfolio. And then even after I left college, I still continued like finding small clients, people who knew me from my hometown, built stuff for them, designed stuff for them, got to know people. I think the biggest part of it for me was building a network, because it's one thing if I say, if I wake up in the morning and I go, oh, I'm a designer now, but no one knows I'm a designer, versus me saying I'm a designer, but I've built up the network and the connections and people know that I'm a designer, and they can say, oh, Amelie is a designer, you should go to her and she can hook you up.
Yeah. And what were your first years out of college like? Like, will you take us, I know you've been doing this for a long time, but kind of briefly take us through your trajectory as a designer?
Mm-hmm.
The Cliff Notes version.
Okay. So, Cliff Notes version. I got out of college. I felt lost and confused. Then I tried going to art school, and I hated it because it was in Philadelphia. Then I went to the school of... Then I went to the School of Visual Arts, and I loved it. But then I had to take time off because my mom was sick. So during that time, when I was kind of waffling, like unsure of where to live, unsure of how to really get started as a designer, I just did a lot of freelance jobs. And actually, most of the freelance jobs came from Craigslist. Like, it was super sketchy. I just, people were like, I'm looking for a website. And I'd be like, yo, you want a website though? So, that's how it worked. So, yeah.
That is amazing. We can just end there.
Yeah.
So it is as we've just talked about, it's challenging early on to gain the experience that you need to apply for the jobs that you want, right? Because everyone wants you to have previous experience. How do you get the job if you don't have experience, but then you need, you know, it's a chicken and egg situation, right? Which one comes first? So you are a big advocate for giving juniors in tech opportunities to learn and grow. How can design as an industry help and be more welcoming to junior designers in tech?
I think one thing that we can do to be more welcoming is, I actually really hate the term junior designers. I use it because it's what people know and can most understand, but I believe that the title itself, junior designer, specifically refers to a role within a company. Outside of a job, you're just a designer. And I think that in terms of being a designer, what your skill level is, it's a matter of how much you're willing to put in order for you to grow. So even if I've been a designer for 10 years, there's still a lot more for me to learn. Just because you're a junior designer and you don't know all of the super fancy terminology, or you may not know design history, doesn't mean that you're any less of a designer than I am. And so I think that the first thing that needs to happen is that the industry needs to understand that it's not necessarily about skill level. It's about the willingness to solve problems, because that's what design is.
That's great. So I want to shift a little bit and talk about your current work. Mm-hmm. You are a product designer at the New York Times. Tell me a little bit about that role and what you do on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah. So at the New York Times, I currently work on what is called the customer products team. And essentially what that is managing the relationship between the Times and the customer. So that would be updating your billing information, changing your profile information, updating your credit card info, et cetera. And then in terms of what a day-to-day looks like, it's as corporate as you would expect. So there is a project manager, a product manager, multiple developers, and then myself and another designer. And what we usually do is we will announce a project to, say, like the marketing team, because that's kind of like who we hold ourselves accountable to. Long story, don't want to talk about it. And so we'll tell the marketing team that we'll have a product or a product feature ready for them in 9 weeks, and then we'll split up the work over the 9 weeks. And usually my role involves interfacing with the developers, interfacing with marketing, making sure that we have all of the assets, and then building out the flows and the features, and then handing it off and then launching it.
And in addition to your full-time job, you have other passion projects, things that you do on the side, like Good for POC, which you launched this June. Yep. With a couple of friends. So will you tell us a little bit about Good for POC and its mission?
Yeah. So Good for POC, it stands for Good for People of Color. And essentially, it's this database that helps you as a person of color find safe and inclusive tech companies to work for. And the words safe and inclusive are really important, because my background is that I came from a tech company where, I'm just going to say it, where my manager told me that she skipped me in a meeting because I was so black, I blended into the chair. And so just having that experience, like it's very clearly overt racism, but a lot of people of color and just people who are members of marginalized communities in general tend to face situations and interactions that are far less overt, they're quite covert. And so I figured, okay, well, if this is happening to me and that was so overt, then it must be happening to other people. What can we do to create a coalition where we're creating a list of companies that are where that wouldn't happen to someone?
Yeah. Yeah. And you, if people want to read, I know you've published your whole story about that experience. Mm-hmm. I heard your reaction. So if you guys do want to read more about that and learn more about what Amelie is doing with her work, you can go to...
So you can go to my website. That would be www.amelielamotte.com.
And I want to talk about this a little bit more when I bring our second guest up as well. But I have one more question for you before we do that. And so you've been doing this work for about a decade, mm-hmm. which is a really long time. At what point did you begin to feel really confident in your skills? Are you laughing because...
Sorry.
These are the questions that we ask ourselves when we're starting out, right? Like, when am I going to feel confident? Does it ever happen?
Oh my goodness. I don't even think I can answer that, because even now I don't feel confident. This sounds like super dorky, but I had a one-to-one with my manager 2 weeks ago where I was like, did you hire me because of affirmative action? And he was like, Jesus Christ, no. And I was like, okay, cool. Just wanted to make sure, because, you know, I don't even know why I'm here, though. Hi, it's cool. It's cool. And he didn't even know what to do with that. So there's definitely, you know, that feeling of like, wow, like, I'm at the New York Times. Or even when I get like a freelance gig, like, wow, like, you want to work with me? Like, that thought still goes through my head. And I know deep down that I do go to work and that the work that I do is valuable and very important, but there's always that little voice in the back that's questioning.
Yeah, and I think that's the point, because you have been doing this work for a decade. You're very skilled, knowledgeable. You have a lot of experience. We struggle and wrestle with self-doubt throughout the course of our careers. It's not like, okay, I've made it now. I can put that little voice away, put it to rest. Yeah. It's always there, right?
Yeah, always.
What has been the most rewarding experience for you thus far in your career?
I would say the most rewarding experience thus far was definitely launching Good for POC. So for Good for POC, we had a launch party. And so many people came up to me and the other two co-founders and were like, thank you so much for creating this space. I never knew something like this could even exist. It's just nice to connect with other people of color in tech and design. And just hearing that, it may not seem like such a big thing. And we hear it a lot in like the media that representation matters, but it really, truly does matter. It's such a comforting feeling to know that if there are struggles that you're facing, you're not the only one going through them, and someone who can connect with you on that level is really important.
Okay, if you've ever heard a podcast before, you've likely heard of MailChimp. But it really is true, MailChimp is the easiest way to send email newsletters. If you're looking to connect with an audience or grow your creative business, you've got to give MailChimp a try. It's easy to set up, it's easy to use, there are flexible design options that make it so simple to create a great-looking campaign. And let's say you're putting on an event in Chicago and you only want to email people that are from Chicago. MailChimp's powerful automation and segmentation tools make this easy with just a few clicks. Plus, with MailChimp's mobile app, you can manage lists, add new subscribers, send campaigns, and view reports all while on the go. Getting started with MailChimp could not be easier. No expiring trials, no contracts, no credit card required. Just sign up and start emailing now. Go to MailChimp.com to create your free account today. Thank you, MailChimp, for supporting the Great Discontent podcast. Now back to the show.
So I'm going to bring up our second guest here. A nice little fancy intro. Our second guest is a New York City-based designer, illustrator, and author of two books. His clients include Google, J.Crew, MoMA, Target, New Yorker, and The New York Times. He co-created the blog and book 40 Days of Dating, the blog 12 Kinds of Kindness, and multiple protests and voting initiatives against Donald Trump with his creative partner, Jessica Walsh. He enjoys sharing personal stories on Instagram also. Please welcome Timothy Goodman. Oh, you can keep. Yeah, you get to sit in the hot seat.
Okay.
Right there.
Hi, everyone.
Welcome.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course.
I got to make sure to put this mic in the left hand. So I don't like
it. All right.
You did very well.
You're getting a look.
Thank you. Yeah.
So you have to live up to, you have some high expectations.
True. I'm not as funny as Amelie.
So Tim, I think I first met you about 3 years ago when we interviewed you for thegreatdiscontent.com.
Yeah, it was about 3 years.
Learned ago. Your whole life story.
It was right after we did 40 Days of Dating.
Yeah, that's what I was going to mention. It was right after that. So I know you are very prolific. You've done a lot of work, traveling, speaking since then. What have you been up to in the last 3 years? High level.
Jeez,
highlights. Wow.
Highlights. just working like everyone, I think, right? Like just trying to... save some money and, you know, make some work that perhaps makes a difference to your life or to someone else's life in any way you can. That's, you know, at the core, that's what I think I'm really trying to do, and how we talk about, how we tell stories, whether they're personal stories or on the internet, and try to connect to people, I think is really important for me at this moment.
Yeah, and you've done a lot of work, of course, like commercial work, but also personal projects.
Yeah.
12 Kinds of Kindness.
Yeah.
And then all the Trump protests and all of those things. So when I spoke with you a couple years ago, you kind of divided your professional life into these three chapters. And I'm going to quote you here. You said, I've essentially gone through...
I didn't see this photo up here. Sorry. I'm like totally ashamed right now. No, it's a good photo. Ryan took the photo. So. It's just weird to me, you know, you're like, oh, there's me. Sorry.
It's kind of like hearing
it's
your own
like
voice.
It's such like a modelly pose too. It's like, I don't know.
Wow.
So in the past 3 years, you've been modeling and also doing work. So when we spoke about three years ago, you said that your career has basically consisted of these three chapters. And I want to quote what you said. You said, because it's easier for me to quote you than, you know, recap in my own words. You said, I've essentially gone through three stages and taken three big risks throughout my career. As a house painter in my early 20s, deciding that I was going to change my life by going back to school and becoming a designer was a big risk. The next was leaving New York City to work for Apple with a stint in San Francisco, and then eventually quitting Apple. And the third risk was working for myself. So I want to go back to that 20-year-old Tim who was hanging out, painting houses in Cleveland, Ohio, right?
Yeah.
What was the aha moment for you to quit house painting and change your life? Was there one moment, or was it kind of like a build-up of moments?
I think it's a gradual process, you know? Like, so first of all, you know, I didn't grow up with any money. You know, when you grow up kind of poor... I think you tend to think about things a little bit differently because you only have an idea of how things could be, you know? And I think that growing up, I didn't have a lot of, I barely graduated high school. I was like doing drugs all the time and partying, and like I didn't really have any stability. And I grew up without my biological father, and I think that played a lot into it. And I think there was a lot of rage towards not having, you know, missing, having a void in my life, and also, I don't know, some sort of like, backlash retaliation against my mom, even though she was amazing, but you just kind of are like a teenager. And so I think, you know, when I started working I was just a laborer, you know, I was like hauling buckets of wallpaper glue up steps for like 12 hours a day. And I had this really great mentor who was my boss at the time. And I think that during that process, you know, I never had a man raise his voice at me, for instance, you know, like someone tell me, I mean, my mom was very lenient, you know, so I kind of could just lie and be like, yeah, I did my homework. And she would be like, cool, because she was like busy trying to put food on the table, you know. And so I think that having this person, Dave, who challenged me, someone that really challenged me for the first time in my life over a course of a year, 2 years, 3 years, really started, and he had this really, you know, he ran a home improvement company, a painting company, but he had this really great house and this really great family. And so he became this kind of like template for me, you know, and this blueprint to say, oh, if I work hard, if I go after things I want, maybe, you know, I could have better things in life or something, or maybe I could do, have some sort of stimulation by the work I'm doing. Because I come from a very blue-collar background and where people don't like their jobs and people, so when I go home now, it's like there's always this little bit of like half being proud and half being like, yo, what's, you know, like, fuck you, kind of like, so it's weird.
Like this, people are saying that to you, or you're saying
yeah,
that
like
to people?
You think you're better than us or something.
Yeah.
So there's always some sort of like tension that I think is really interesting. And for myself too, like how to like navigate that.
And so you, through Dave, who was like kind of a mentor to you, not that you said you're my mentor, you just were around him and he was influencing your life. You decided to study design and you eventually, you took some classes at community college, right?
Yeah. I was working full time and I was going to a community college in Cleveland, Tri-C full time. So I started going nights and weekends. So I was like obsessed with trying to figure out what I was going to do, how I was going to maybe get. I remember telling him too, who was this like great positive influence. I was like, I'm going to figure out and go to art school and like maybe go to a metropolitan area like New York or LA. And he was like, you have Kool-Aid dreams, you know? And like, I still tell him that. And he's like, you're lying. I never said that. I'm like, no, you did. Luckily, unfortunately, I don't have receipts, but, but yeah, so it was like, so I was going to, I was at Tri-C full time. And during that course, I was like, I'm going to figure out how to go to New York and go to school, to go to design school. And it's crazy. I read this book called How to Go to School for Free. it's a joke. This guy, Ben Kaplan, like I could kiss this guy. Like, I don't even know who he is. He wrote this book, How to Go to College for Free, How to Go to School for Free. And I read this whole book, and it bookends where I'm at now too, because what he teaches you, how to get scholarships. And in order to get scholarships, you have to learn how to write about yourself and differentiate yourself from the next person, because there's thousands of people applying for scholarships. And there's so many, and he also teaches you how there's so many scholarships. There's like scholarships for like, there was like tall people scholarships. I know because I got one.
I missed out on that one. Did you get that one?
So you
applied to like over 50 scholarships, right?
I would work all day and then I'd go home, or I'd do school and then I'd go home and I would write about myself and apply to scholarships. I applied to over 100 scholarships and I think I won like 8 or 9 of them. So it helped me, you know, go to school and pay for such a big debt as our school is.
So when you moved from Cleveland to New York to go to SVA, what was that like? I mean, were you nervous coming from Cleveland? I mean, Cleveland is a bigger city in the Midwest, but compared to New York, it's small. So what was that transition like for you?
I don't know. It's weird because I think I was so blind to it all. Like I was just like, I'm going to try to make this happen. And I think I was like, yeah, there were times where like I saw a cockroach crawl on my floor and I started crying on a Sunday morning. yeah, there were times, but like, I think that at that time I was just like, you know, and I had the kind of, I think when you go to school, when you move to a big place like New York for school, you have some sort of security blanket around you because you're like with other like-minded people and you're kind of, you're busy with what's going on. So it wasn't like I was like, whatever, Madonna who moved to New York with a dollar or something. I don't know, like, or whoever, like, I don't know. Like, so I think when you're in school, you kind of have that comfort. But I think, yeah, it was I was super country about things.
And so you are a big proponent, like you've taught at SVA. I don't know if you're currently teaching there or
I took the year off, but yeah.
Okay, yeah. So you're a teacher and you probably give a lot of advice to students. And I know one of the things you say is don't worry so much about what you want to do, but who you want to work for,
yeah.
Which is so important. And so what have you learned? Are there any specific things that have stuck with you that you've learned from people that you've worked with over the years?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the reason I say that is because I'm just a big believer, like because of my background and having so many mentors and always looking for mentors. I think that especially as a young designer, trying to find someone who you can learn from, because you're always going to be learning from someone, or it's always important to try to find yourself in a position where you're learning from someone at your job or with your work. And so I forgot the question. What was the question?
Totally cool. I can repeat. Have you learned anything that has stuck out from people that you've worked with over the years?
I mean, there's all kinds of things. Like, from mentors I've had that have just taught me. I mean, a lot of times you also learn what not, how not to do things, you know? And also you learn how complex people are, you know? It's like what you were saying, like, what were you saying about heroes? What was she saying?
If you're listening at home, he's pointing at Amelie and asking her something about she said about heroes. Do you recall?
Kill your heroes or something, or like, I don't know. Or all your faves are problematic.
Yes, that is what I said.
All your faves are problematic.
But that wasn't like here in front of them. They don't know.
No, you were saying it earlier. I'm sorry. I'm not good at this. I'm so
Do you want to elaborate on?
Yes. So your faves are problematic. Everyone that you love, everyone that you look up to. I think it happens a lot, especially in design and any media industry. We have people that we kind of put on a pedestal. And the way that I think of it is that if you put someone on a pedestal, then that means that that person's above you, right? That must also mean that you are below them. And if you are below them, then that must also mean that there are people below you. And I personally don't think that that's a good feeling to have. I think we're all human beings, and we all have different gifts and talents to give. So when we put people up in our minds on a pedestal, whether it's a famous designer or a thought leader, I hate that term, but whatever, and we think highly of them, when they take actions that don't meet the expectations that we've crafted in our minds, we find them disappointing, and we get upset, and then we get angry, and then we decide that we hate them. And then we find the next person who is our fave. And that's why I say, you know, your faves are problematic. All of our faves are problematic. Like, they're all flawed human beings. And that's something that we have to keep in mind.
Yeah. Yeah. And so an alternative to that is really just saying, like, I like this person's work. They're flawed. They're human. But I can still learn something from them. And that's okay. So you just mentioned the word expectations, which I want to jump into, and I have some questions for both of you. I'm going to have some dialogue here. One of the things that we, you know, throughout our careers, we have to navigate the expectations of others. And one of the things that we do that a lot of us struggle with early on is navigating the expectations in terms of our whole career path. Do I do something practical, more traditional? Do I do something that is more creative, that doesn't have specific steps that I can take to achieve success? So that's like the first expectation that we have to navigate, which is a really challenging one. But it doesn't stop once you choose your path, right? It continues throughout your career. So I want to ask each of you, Tim, I'll start with you. How do you navigate the expectations of others in your professional career?
It's something that I haven't really struggled with as much because I feel like everyone's always got an idea about what something should be or what you should be. And I think it's really important to just block all that out. You know, I mean, it's very cliche, but like, how do you just cut through all of it and do the work you really want to do? I mean, what I'm saying is that if you have an opportunity to do it, you should do it. Obviously, we all can't do what we want to do. And there's a lot of privilege that's built into all of that, which needs to be acknowledged. But what I'm saying is that if you have an opportunity or something, and, you know, or if you think you want to do something, but you have all these voices in your head about what you should or shouldn't do, or all these naysayers or something, like, I think it's important to really, you know, kind of cut through all that and try to figure out what, you know, what you really want to do and what you want to say, and how do you try to do that and put that on the world as best as possible.
For me, I'm going to get a little woo-woo here, because I think that when it comes to expectations, about to get deep, when people are really sad and there's depression and anger in the world, I can't believe I'm saying this, it is often because there are human beings who have had expectations about X, and another set of human beings who took actions that did not match the original expectations. And so for me, in my career, kind of bringing it back, what I do to manage other people's expectations is I try to set the bar really low, like mad low. Like, for reals, really low. Because if you, if I like set this bar that, you know, I'm going to do like this really great, amazing thing. Like, again, like I know that I do good work. I believe in my work. I know that I do high quality work. And whether I'm talking with a client or I'm talking with someone at work, like obviously I'll display the knowledge that I need to display in order to come across as competent, but I always try to under promise and then over deliver. That's kind of my philosophy. So even one project that I'm working on right now, we set a kind of like a weekly deadline for like the next few weeks where I would deliver a set number of wireframes every week. And I was like, yeah, 5 wireframes and screens at the end of the week. In 2 weeks, I delivered 50. So, I mean, that's kind of what I do, because I didn't put myself in a situation where I told them that I was going to do 50 screens in 2 weeks, because I probably am not going to do that. And if I don't deliver, then it's going to disappoint them, versus setting very low expectations and then exceeding them.
How do you think?
I think, can I just add one thing?
Yeah, go ahead.
I think it's also for me, because I work for myself, and we didn't talk much about my, my client work, but I do a lot of installations and murals and stuff. And so people, you know, a lot of clients or brands come to me for one or two kinds of specific things. And a lot of times the way I'm able to push through that is to maybe give them what they want, but also say, here's this though that I did. Which also, you know, that will require more time, more resources, whatever. But sometimes it's about making that extra leap to be like, no, but what about this? Or sometimes it's just like they come to me for something and I just don't even listen to them. And I say, well, what about this? And now that's a risk, because I could lose that client, I could lose the money, I could lose the time. But a lot of times if you're thoughtful and considerate about the way you put it forward, you can, more often than not, you can gain a lot with that. Which has been something that I've been able to do with a lot of clients.
Yeah, that's a good point. When you become known for a particular style or kind of work, breaking out of those expectations can be challenging too.
Yeah.
So like, what makes you, especially when your ability to pay your bills depends on that, what helps you be brave enough to break outside of those expectations and experiment and try new things?
For me, it's always been about trying to just... Well, I think it's different for everyone, obviously. You know, I don't have a family. I don't have I'm not married. I don't have kids. I don't have significant bills that way, where I think that obviously plays into your time, your resources, and all that. So that all has to be considered. But if you can find the time, if you can make time, you know, nothing is possible unless you make time, clearly. So it's like, how do you do that? Like, whether that is just giving up parts of your personal life at moments in your life to figure something out on weekends or nights, as I did when I had a full-time job, you can start to carve out space to like create things, you know, for yourself or to do client work that may not be able to pay bills, but that allows you freedom, creativity, you know, creative freedom that you can kind of like start to kind of like chisel and work on us on something. I think that can obviously be of help.
I'm gonna pull a Tim. I forgot the question.
No, I was just asking what makes you, or what helps you be brave enough to break outside of others' expectations in terms of the style of your work or the kinds of work that you do.
You're not gonna like this answer. What helps me be brave enough, especially with clients, is that I know that I'm smarter than them. I know that's so disrespectful. I know that's so rude. But I am. I am. No, for reals though, I am. I know my shit. I'm really good at it. Obviously, I don't say it to them like that. But oftentimes than not, like, same thing for me. I will get clients who will come to me for very specific things because they have an expectation about my style of work. And I'm able to talk to them in a way that gets them to see, like, actually, she really knows what she's talking about. Let's go in that direction instead, because oftentimes people just need a little bit of guidance.
Yeah. My old boss used to always say, everyone says design is problem solving, you know, but what about problem making? And that's always been something that I've thought about in terms, because when I worked for him, he was always encouraging us to, like, quote unquote, fuck shit up. Brian Collins, maybe anyone might know him. He was a branding company here called Collins. And he was one of my first bosses, and he was amazing for me as a young designer, because he encouraged me to, like, all right, here's this brief or this identity project or this branding project. Do the thing we need to do, but then also go off and do what you want to do as well and present that, and let's figure that out, you know? And that's something that I think about a lot in terms of, because, you know, a lot of my own personal work is problem making. You know, we create projects or experiments, me and Jessica, and then we kind of create parameters around them, and then we have to kind of go through it. Now, there's debate for me whether that's even a design project or not, or if it's an experiment, but I think it's an interesting notion.
Yeah, totally. So I want to shift and talk about Twitter, because you guys are both active on there and outspoken. Mm-hmm. Also, I just have to say, there's nothing, I mean, everything is okay to say here. So,
of course.
I like all your answers.
We're only on a podcast.
That's right.
Thousands of people. It's all safe. It's only us, 100 people.
Only the world will hear you. So Twitter. So you both are very active. Emily, you share about the work you're doing, daytime, your work at the Times, good for POC. You also speak up and advocate for marginalized groups. Tim, you've become very outspoken in terms of encouraging inclusiveness in the design world and challenging your cohorts and design to really address racism and discrimination that is prevalent in the tech world. So my question to both of you is, I'm wondering what the responses have been like, because often, you know, Twitter feels like sometimes you're shouting into a void. So have you been able to engage in meaningful dialogue, or have you just been trolled? Or a little bit of both?
No.
This is gonna be
fun. No meaningful dialogue. I mean, it's mostly being trolled by people. That's why I'm laughing, because I actually did try to have a meaningful conversation on Twitter once when I foolishly decided to dive into a hashtag. And when I dove into that hashtag, a bunch of like trolls were like, "You're so dumb." Because I think it was during one of the debates, and Trump had mentioned that we should go back to the original view of the Constitution. And I like sardonically wrote on Twitter that, "Oh, great. So let's just interpret the Constitution exactly as the framers interpreted it as and wrote it as. BRB, gonna go pick some cotton." And it was just terrible. But it like picked up steam, and a bunch of trolls were like, yeah, you should go pick up cotton because black people are dumb. And I'm like, a word though? Like, where are your statistics at though? And they're like, well, there's science. And I'm like, aye, but where's the science though? Where are your sources at? And it was like back and forth. It just kept going. They're like, you're a stupid face. And I was like, I kind of feel sorry for you, because it feels like you have a limited vocabulary, because all you keep doing is hurling insults at me. And he's like, well, I use stupid because you're actually stupid. And I was like, that's not how that works. Look, I'm trying to talk with you. So most of the Twitter conversations I've had are usually into a void. It's usually, if trolls find it, then I get trolled, but I just block
them. Are they random people? Are they designers? Do you have any design?
No design trolls, but I do follow designers. And when I see them tweet problematic stuff, I fuck their shit up.
Yeah, that's really good.
Because I can't have you being a designer. Sorry, a design thought leader, and posting crazy shit. Like, that's just not gonna work. I gotta set you straight.
Tim, do you want to add about your experiences?
So, I mean, I've definitely been vocal on Twitter, especially in the last couple months. I mean, I've done a lot of work about regarding the Trump stuff, as you mentioned earlier. And surprisingly, I haven't gotten, although I did get, like, you know, there's always going to be some designers who are like, why are you doing this? You should do it that way. Or you shouldn't, you know, which is, but as far as what you're saying about inclusiveness, you know, so part of it, what this stems from, is that over the last couple of years, I've been very lucky to literally travel the world for my job, for whether I'm speaking or doing workshops or doing murals. And one of the number one questions I hear from people of color and women is, what can I do to get recognized for my work? You know, and one of the number one questions I hear from white young designers or students is, you know, what opportunity should I take next? And that's been, really, obviously eye-opening for me. Now I think I'm, you know, obviously from my background, I grew up with all black people until I was like 12 or 13. I didn't even know I was like white until I was like 8. We were talking about this earlier. So there, I have a whole history of so I didn't recognize my privilege early on, but now that I do, and I'm very vocal about my own me being blind to my privileges in the past as well. And I think it's constantly something you have to fight against and acknowledge and recognize and check yourself as a white person, but also as a white person who has a quote unquote influence or people follow you or you have some sort of audience. You know, now more than ever, I think it's really important to be talking about your privilege, to be checking yourself, to be checking your other white friends or your family members or whatever, and talking about this more and more. And so it's been a something that I've been tweeting a lot about. It's amazing. It kind of started a couple months ago, and I did this one tweet. I said, I tweeted, like, you know, white designer guys with influence, like, please, you know, if you're getting asked to speak at a conference, like, you know, tell people, you know, tell these people that curate these conferences, you know, that, you know, you don't want to do this unless there's going to be a significant balance of women and people of color with you. And this is not something that I've always, it's important that, you know, it's amazing what was so sad to me when I did that. There was a lot of really good conversation around it. Sadly, most people that challenged it were white guys. Which is sad. But then also what was really sad for me too is all the emails and DMs that I got from people saying, wow, like, thank you. I've never seen a white person with a following say that, a white guy with a following say something like that. I know, it's just like, holy shit, like, what is going on?
That's your privilege. You have a platform to speak.
Yeah, and why aren't we talking about this more? So it's still something that I'm trying to figure out what happens next with that. But I think first things first is talking about it, acknowledging it, challenging it, and then, you know, kind of going forward with it. And I've been very vocal on Instagram too, because Instagram is my preferred medium. and so I've actually had a lot of good conversation on Instagram, weirdly enough, about it. But again, the people that keep challenging me are white guys. Like, you know, or what, like when I recently Instagrammed this thing about the fucking safety pin. Which is so, it's like, and then everyone who was upset about it were white people. And then my black friends and my friends who are LGBT, like, they were all saying, fuck those safety pins. We don't want, you know, and it was interesting to kind of like, and it's, so.
I was going to ask, just people listening to the podcast at home, can you give a little context about the Instagram, the safety pin Instagram, just so if people are listening,
I write a lot of things on Instagram, and one thing I wrote was you know, I just write it and it's like a drawing or whatever, lettering piece. And I said, you know, white people trying to wear safety pins when Trump just put a white supremacist in the White House, you know. And so, and then there was like a caption that kind of followed through. It's like, you know, if you want to show support, A, B, C, D, E, here's all the ways you can start to show support or be an ally or whatever. Like, your fucking safety pin that's going to make you feel better isn't doing anything. Now, you know, I've learned a lot since then too. Obviously, I think there could be, like, you know, someone was telling me that they're a teacher and they wear them, and so if students feel like they can sit next to them on the bus or something, I think they're, but, you know, I think it's they're very complex topics, you know, so.
And I think, and your point was, you can't just wear a safety pin and feel good about yourself. Like,
yeah.
There are actions that you can take in your daily life that are very easy steps to use your privilege and platform to support marginalized groups. And which is really the heart of what you were getting at. So Twitter is often, as we've just discussed, not the best medium for these kinds of conversations, but it's a lot easier to have that dialogue in person, especially if it's someone you're in relationship with, because it's really impossible to demonize someone that you know, because you know them and you have a connection to them. So since we're talking in person tonight, Amelie, I'm wondering, what do you wish that people with privilege understood about you that you don't think they understand? We're not on Twitter, so you can say whatever you want. No one's going to troll.
I think one of the things that I wish that people with more privilege would understand is twofold. I don't care about your feelings. And number two, I think I forgot what I was going to say. No. Number two is, I also don't care about your intentions. So oftentimes than not, what happens is we'll get into a situation where, an example would be like after the election, an acquaintance, like someone who I barely know, just like never really spoken with him. Like I know him through other people, and we were like in the same room on like the day after the election. And he came up to me and he was like, "Hey," and I was like, "The fuck is you doing? Like, I don't even know. I've never spoken to you, okay?" And I was like, "Hi," because I don't want to talk to anybody. It was a day after election day and Trump won. Get the fuck away from me. So I was like, "Hi," and he was like, "Yeah," and I was like, "The fuck? Can you like go over there? Like, what is going on?" And then it was just like silent. And then he was like, "Are you in mourning?" And I was like, "Wait, I'm in mourning because I'm black? Like, is that why you came over to me? Like, I. So, like, I get what he was trying to do. Like, I'm sure in his head, like, so it's not, when I say I don't care about your feelings and I don't care about your intentions, it's not like I'm saying it to be rude or mean or that I don't understand the perspective. I actually really do understand the perspective. And I would even venture as far to say that I'm a person of color, a woman of color, who very strongly understands perspectives and experiences that are above my own in the hierarchy that we've created in this society. The problem is that he just thought that, oh, like, I don't think, like, in his heart he felt like, oh, my God, like, I'm going to go comfort the Negro. Like, I really don't think he thought that. I think he just thought, well, she's a person of color. Like, maybe she's affected by the election results. Maybe I should say something to her, which is, you know, when you like take it out of that context, you're like, oh, that's actually quite meaningful. But the actual actions that he took, it's like people with more privilege oftentimes do not think about their actions and the ripple effects that those actions will have. And so they just act and they move forward, but they're not thinking about how it will be perceived. And then when you talk about it with them, they get very defensive and they say, but my intention, that wasn't my intention. And I'm like, but I literally do not care about your intention because you took an action that was potentially harmful or disrespectful. And we need to talk about that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like the day after the election, I was tweeting because I go on and it's like, I see a flurry of white men saying, stay positive, everything's going to be okay, you know? And it's like, just stop, just shut up. Mm-hmm. Just like, listen, you know?
Yeah, listen is a huge, listening. huge one. Because I get, yeah, even after the election, I had people like say that to me too. And I was like, I literally don't even know how to respond to you because right now the biggest thing that I am fearful of is my life. Like, I'm worried that I'm going to die. Like, even the Saturday after the election, someone tried to fight me in the subway. So this is not a joke. It's not a game. It's not fake. There's no one overreacting. Like, this is what is happening in our country right now, and it is very real. And if you are part of a marginalized community, you are scared. Like, the level of fear that many of us feel is literally indescribable.
Yeah, that you said that, it makes me think of some tweet that was going around right after election saying, if you still don't understand what white privilege is, just look at all your friends of color or disenfranchised communities, LGBTQ, and look how scared they are, and then look at how you're not scared. And that's, you know.
And I think you said listen. I mean, listening is so important. I mean, that's one thing that we can all do daily, listen to someone and really try to hear what they're saying and empathize with their experiences, because they're experiencing things that you have never experienced or never will. Tim, what do you want to say to people with privilege about advocating for others? You know, in term, kind of in line with how you in your own life have had this realization of your privilege and have decided to take action and help.
Well, I think it starts with listening, as we're talking about here. As I just said, like, it really does begin with that. And also recognizing your crew. Like, if everyone in your world looks like you, I don't know. Like, I don't know I can't say, you know, go find, like, just, you can't just make, don't make friends with people just because, but like something, you're obviously, your viewpoint is different and shifted. And like, and I think it's important to, especially if you live in New York, like, I don't know how you could just only have, but I don't, it's a whole other story. But I think it starts with listening. It starts with, so if you don't have people in your life that if everyone looks like you, then you need to follow people on Twitter or read things or what, you know, it begins with that as well.
Well, one thing I would like just to quickly jump in with that is that if you're surrounded by people who all look like you, the one thing I would question is, like, and ask yourself is why? Why are you surrounded by people who all look like you? So, like, a good example is, let's be honest, like, I am a well-spoken Black woman. I dress in a certain way. I carry myself in a certain way. And if I did not behave in the way that I do, speak in the way that I do, dress in the way that I do, I already know that there are certain people in the tech community, the design community, any industry who would perceive me to be either less intelligent or less worthy of their time. And even though most people may not necessarily think that, they do that automatically, I think it's kind of ingrained in us, especially specifically in American society, this sense of anti-Blackness, this expectation of how someone is going to behave, kind of going back to what I was saying before about expectations. And so I think when you're trying to expand that circle of people you know and people you're interacting with, the most important thing that you could do is let go of those expectations. And that's way more easily said than done, trust me. But I think that letting go of those expectations would allow you to expand away from what makes you comfortable so that you can meet more people and learn about their experiences and learn a new perspective.
And also dealing with your white guilt, you know, and as my friend Margaret always said, and you were touching on this, like white fragility. Like, we don't, like, they don't, no one has time for our white fragility. And it's like, how do you deal with that on some level? Because we all do, and we have privilege, and that's just a fact. It doesn't make you a bad person or something. You know what I mean? It's just how you were born, and it's what, and you were born, and you live in the society that gives you privilege. So it's about acknowledging that, talking about it, listening to people, and then thinking about how you can, you know, in whatever position you are in and start from, whether that is, you know, helping with things, protesting, donating, you know, if you do have an audience or a platform, using that to talk about things, if you, you know, and so on and so forth. It has to start from wherever you are, I think, to go forth. So.
Yeah, that's really good. Thank you for all of those insights. That was super, super profound. So this year has been a challenging year. I've seen all kinds of talk online about, you know, 2016 has been a real shit show. And we are getting very close to the end of the year. I think we're all ready to see 2016 go. But I've also seen some goodness this year. And so I don't want to end our last show of the year on a negative note. I want to talk about some of the goodness we've seen. And so I guess I want to ask you guys, what goodness have you witnessed or experienced this year? It couldn't have all been bad, right?
Well, on a macro level?
On a, you know, it can be something personal you've experienced, something you've witnessed in your community or the world, just any kind of goodness. Give us a glimmer of hope.
There's only darkness. Dear. I'm kidding. One thing that I read on Twitter yesterday that, like, made me go, like, aww, was a woman. I don't remember her name, but she is an out gay woman, and she lives somewhere in the Midwest, and she works at a comic book shop. And there was a young teenage girl who came in who was, like, very anxious, like, very jumpy, and she went over to this young girl and was like, hey, like, can I help you with anything? And then the girl just starts crying, and she's like, I just asked you if you wanted help. Like, what did I do to make you start crying? And then she said at that moment it kind of clicked, and she realized that this young woman was, like, kind of coming to terms with her lesbianism. And so she, like, was like, oh, okay. So, like, showed her, like, all these comics that she should look into, and talked with her about, like, how she can, like, come to terms with it, because the young girl, teenage girl, said that she thought about killing herself multiple times and she didn't want to live, and she wasn't sure if she could be accepted. But she actually watched the Supergirl show, and there is a relationship with two female characters, and that kind of inspired her to be like, oh, okay, like, if I'm a lesbian, like, I will still be loved, like, I don't have to kill myself. And so she showed her all these comics to buy, but she only had money for, I think, one of the comics. So she took money out of her own paycheck to buy the comics for this girl, and I was just like, that's amazing. And then she was like, you don't have to pay me back, just make sure that when you get older, if you encounter someone else who's LGBT, just, like, pay it forward and, like, do the same thing for them. So I was like, oh, that's so nice.
Wow. I don't know if I have anything to say.
That's right.
That's pretty. I would just say really quickly what just happened with Standing Rock.
Yes, yes.
So, yeah, I mean, that's just so amazing and profound, and it just shows you what the will of people can do. And it just, I think it reinforces all of us that we're going to have to fight for 4 years and whatever we can do to keep going forward and keep pushing in the fight in whatever way we can as a people in this whole country, you know? And so, and to not let go, not give up, you know? So
standing up for your rights, regardless of how you do it, is never a fruitless action to take.
Yeah. And that shows, because I think a lot of times it feels like it can just be, you know, in vain or something. So.
Yeah, that's really good. So I have one last question for each of you. What do you want to remind us of for the new year? Not necessarily a resolution, but maybe advice or a challenge or a call to action for all of us, something for us to think about as we are heading into 2017. Who would like to go first? Or should I choose?
Timothy would like to go first.
No. Wait, can you say it again?
I sure can. I'm gonna say it again so that you have time to think about it. So the question is, as we are all heading into 2017, you know how we'd like to do that, I'm gonna make a New Year's resolution, which you don't really wanna make and you aren't gonna stick to anyway. So instead of talking about resolutions, what is something that you want all of us to think about as we head into 2017? Maybe a challenge or a call to action, just something for us to have on our minds.
You know, so I say this a lot, but I love this quote from Lena Dunham, who's a problematic.
Flawed and human.
Wow. Yes. But I do like this quote because it's something I subscribe to a lot with my own work. And it's, she says something along the lines of, sharing your own stories is a sort of activism. By sharing what's personal to you, you connect to other people, other lonely people in the world. And so it's something that I think a lot about. With a lot of the projects I do, because the idea of sharing whatever's on your mind, whatever's going on, is very important in a community, whether that's in person, whether that's online, Twitter, whatever. And I do see like that sort of thing going around a lot, that connectivity, that is important, that dialogue amongst a lot of people. And I just think it's important to just like constantly like keep speaking up, keep shouting out, keep talking, keep challenging, like for all of us, like we have to. And there's no room to be polite anymore in some sense, you know? And it's like, I mean, you can be considerate and respectful, but like, I think it's important to just at this point to kind of to keep shouting and going forward with it all. So I don't know. I don't know if that made sense.
Good luck.
It did. It was good.
You're going to have something much more.
Mine's going to be great. So my advice, or what I want everyone to do, is I think we live in a world where it's really easy to judge others. It's very easy to stand up and point at that person and that person and say, oh, this is what I think about them. These are my thoughts about this person. This is how I feel like they operate and move through the world. If there's any challenge that I could leave with everyone, it would be for 2017, hold up a mirror to yourself instead of to other people. I think that even though we live in our bodies and we move and we exist in this world within our bodies, we oftentimes don't know ourselves as well as we think we do. And I also think that there's always more to learn. Are there certain habits and behaviors that you're exhibiting that aren't necessarily good for you and maybe good for the people around you in your life as well? And I think it takes a certain level of self-awareness in order to be able to see that and to examine it and to dissect it and figure out how to move forward. But that all first starts with holding up a mirror to yourself.
That's incredible. Those are all the questions I have for you. Tim, Amelie, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you. Thanks, guys.
This episode was produced by The Great Discontent and me, Benjamin Welch, with sound mixing by Ryan Essmaker. The Great Discontent features conversations with today's artists, makers, and risk takers. You can learn more at thegreatdiscontent.com. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes or wherever you find your podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode, consider giving us a rating in iTunes. It really does help spread the word. Thanks so much for listening.